Gina Kaufman, and for the rest of today's show, we'll be talking with KU history professor Eric Rath, who's been studying Japanese desserts. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Oh, thank you very much.
You are the editor of the East Asian section of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. That's a worldwide survey of sweet things. What were the main ideas you wanted to be sure you covered in this really authoritative resource?
Well, actually, I thought I would be just responsible for East Asia, but then I started getting entries that I had to edit on all sorts of different things, like mooncakes and sweet names in sports and things like that. So I learned a great deal about sugar and sweets throughout the world. But for East Asia, I wanted to introduce people to the wide variety and the history of East Asian sweets, particularly in Japan. That's my area of specialty.
How did you get interested in Japanese sweets as a historian?
Right. Well, I became interested in Japanese food living in Kyoto. I was wrapping up some other research and I wanted to always work in a Japanese restaurant. And so that led me to research Japanese food. And
why did you want to work in a Japanese restaurant?
That's one of the things I always wanted to try, be behind stage. I guess that was my theater background. I wanted to see what's behind the curtain. How does all the magic happen? And that's what prompted me to work at a Japanese restaurant, just doing odd jobs mostly.
And this is while you were studying history in Kyoto?
I was studying history, wrapping up a dissertation on Japanese traditional theater. And I saw a want ad posted outside. And I thought, well, I'll just give it a shot. And I went inside and got
the
job.
Check working in a Japanese restaurant off your bucket list.
Exactly, exactly.
What did you observe there that captivated you and made you connect that history study with that food experience?
Yeah, I was a theater historian, so I was really struck by the performance aspects of Japanese food, especially if you sit at the counter. This was a very small restaurant, and if you sit at the counter, you get to interact with the chef, and it's very dramatic. He wields this knife to cut the sashimi that looks like a samurai sword, about the same length. And there's wonderful aspects of presentation. The dishes come out one after another. You eat one, and then you rest for a while, have a little drink, and then you get another dish. And they're all artfully, beautifully presented. And I thought, wow, there's a lot of connections here between theater, performance, and food. So I became interested in that.
So give me the kind of the Cliff Notes version of the history of dessert in Japan specifically.
Right. Well, you can break down Japanese sweets into two different types. There's Western sweets, and they arrived in the late 19th century. And then we have Japanese sweets, and they have a much longer history. And we say Japanese sweets, but really, there's Chinese influence there, and then there's the influence of the Portuguese who arrived. Yes, in the 16th century.
Explain that.
Well, in their travels around the world, the Portuguese arrived in Japan by mistake in 1543, and then decided, well, this would be a great opportunity for trade and for missionary work. And so they discovered very quickly that the Japanese had a taste for sweets and that China had a great agricultural region that could provide sugar. So they brought sugar to Japan, acted as a middleman, made a lot of money doing that. But initially, they had to teach the Japanese how to work with the sugar. And they did, gradually teaching them how to make hard candies, cakes, and so on.
What is different about Japanese desserts? Like, how did they develop? They're developing with a strong Portuguese influence, but do they diverge from Western tradition in confectionery things?
I think the most remarkable thing about Japanese sweets, and I'm talking mostly about the ones that are what we consider native sweets, the ones made out of very simple ingredients like sugar, rice flour, azuki bean paste, is that each one of them tells a story. And if you go to a Japanese sweet maker, and there's thousands of these everywhere, I mean, there were something like, 2,000 of them in the city of Edo, which became Tokyo in the early part of the 19th century. And today you see them everywhere. If you go inside, you look inside the display cabinets and you see all these ranges of jewel-like sweets, confections. They look like little Fabergé eggs, and they're all basically made out of the same thing, but they have beautiful colors, beautiful designs, and they each tell a story. They each reflect the seasons or perhaps a reference to a famous poem or a place. So as a food historian, I was very interested in those stories.
Tell me about your favorite Japanese sweet and the story behind it.
That's a difficult question. I have so many favorites. I think one of them that's interesting is the castera, which is a Japanese term derived from Portuguese, literally the Castilian cake that the Portuguese introduced in the latter part of the 16th century. And the Japanese, it's a baked cake, but Japanese didn't have ovens historically. So what do? They created a special type of cooking confectionery, a little box, a metal box, and they'd put this metal box on a heat source and they'd put coals on top of it so that they could bake that way. And they create this cake. It's like a very rich sponge cake. You slice a piece of this and it's more fatty than pork, but it's delicious and it's got so many egg yolks in it and so much sugar. It's a wonderful sweet. You can only just have a little bit of it, I think, at a time.
Hearing about how sugary this dessert is, it's kind of confusing because part of what I've also heard is that Japanese sugar consumption is significantly lower than American sugar consumption.
Right. I think it's about 42 pounds per capita per year annually, whereas in the United States, we consume about over 70 pounds per year of sugar per capita.
So how do you reconcile this, the sugariness of the individual items and, you know, the lesser consumption of sugar?
Right. Well, traditionally, historically, dessert was never really part of a meal. You would have a meal, but maybe later on in the day have tea or earlier in the day have tea. And then that's when this dessert would come out. And it would be very, very small, just small little beautifully constructed Japanese sweets that you would enjoy with tea.
And so just a bite.
Just a bite. And so I think that legacy continues today, even with Western sweets. They're rather small in size.
So you've also recently contributed scholarship on food history in Japan to an art exhibit at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. Tell me about your discovery there, looking into paintings from the Edo period, or
right.
Edo.
Edo period, yeah. Well, there's this remarkable collector in New York City, John Weber, who has this fabulous hand scroll. It's about 30 feet long, and it shows the pleasure quarters, the geisha quarter in Edo, in Tokyo, in the early part of the 17th century. And you would think that the pleasure quarters, you'd see, images of erotica in the painting, but there's none of that at all. And the same artist named Morinobu has some very graphic images of erotica.
But yet these pleasure quarters portray something else.
They portray something else. They portray food, and they portray how the food gets into the pleasure quarters, how it's brought there by people carrying it in, and how it's prepared. So the real drama of this picture scroll is the preparation of food and the serving of it. There's a wonderful scene of the kitchen where people are wrestling with fish, slicing them, filleting them, making all sorts of things. And you kind of wonder, what are they going to prepare and who is it for? It's like imagining Iron Chef or some cooking show where they bring out a challenging ingredient and you wonder, what's the chef going to do with it?
What does seeing this, like chefs at work depicted in pleasure quarters in this historic 1600s painting, what does that tell you? I mean, what is the conclusion you draw from that?
Well, a number of things. First of all, as a historian, we can say this is probably one of the first types of restaurants in Japan were located in these pleasure quarters. And secondly, I think the artist is commenting on the lives of the women in these pleasure quarters, and he's using food to do it. He's equating these women with some of the provisions that are brought there. They are also dressed up.
It's a metaphor?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, is it important for people living in America in 2015 to understand, for example, how Japanese chefs worked in the 1600s when these restaurants came about, how Japanese desserts have evolved? What do we need to know from these things?
Well, I think, first of all, these things are becoming more readily available to us. And I'm always surprised when I go to an Asian market and I see new items for sale. But I also think that these have a tremendous historical legacy. And if you talk with chefs in Japan, they talk about the 1700s and 1600s like it was yesterday. So it's very tangible for them. And if the more we learn about it, the more we can appreciate Japanese food. And Japanese food is riding a big wave now after 2013 with the recognition by UNESCO that Japanese traditional dietary cultures, it's a fancy way of saying Japanese cuisine, is an item of intangible cultural heritage.
When you think about Japanese food as it's experienced by people outside of Japan, what do you think the history could do to, I don't know, inform or enhance those experiences, those dining experiences?
Well, I think it could tell you a little bit about the history of the dishes, like tempura, for example. We associate that with Japanese food, but that's a modification of a Portuguese or perhaps even a Spanish or Dutch recipe that comes to Japan in the late 16th century. But I think also maybe it'll whet people's appetite to learn that there's a greater variety of things out there besides sushi to eat if you actually get a chance to go to Japan.
Is there a big next question you'll be exploring?
I'm looking at different types of cuisine in Japan, and that's my next project, and hopefully it'll be published in the spring of next year.
Keep in touch with us on that.
Thank you.
Eric Rath, professor of history at KU, our time is up. Thanks so much for coming to the studio today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be your dessert today.
Eric has just edited the Asia section of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, which sounds like a delicious book to have around. He visited us from the history department at KU. You can listen back to both of today's conversations about international food and drink history. They'll be available online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Sign up for the Central Standard podcast while you're there. Again, that's kcur.org/centralstandard. And stay in touch with us by following us on Twitter. We're at @KCURCST. Tomorrow, 3 of the 9 economists who predicted the Greek debt crisis are professors at UMKC's economics department. We'll explore UMKC's approach to economics tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Harvest Public Media. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.